I love digging into these questions. Some fascinating thoughts today on the land and the book. Our next question from Gordon. He says, an agnostic friend says that if there's a God, he's not the one of the Bible. And as proof, he cites the, am I saying this right, Gilgamesh flood legend. Charlie, help us understand what that is and what the argument seems to be.
Yeah, and I think there's actually a simple answer for this man. By the way, John, you pronounced that correctly. But there's a simple way to answer the friend's objection. And it's the fact that the Gilgamesh epic contains an account of a worldwide flood. Well, that doesn't argue against the account in the Bible, since there's no evidence that the biblical account borrowed from the Babylonian account. Rather, I think what it really shows is the reality that there was a worldwide flood. The Bible preserves the correct version of the account, which was given by God directly to Moses, while the Babylonian version became distorted as it was passed down over time. You know, if you've ever played that telephone game where someone whispers a phrase and then you whisper it to the person next, you can see how something becomes misunderstood and distorted. And the way I know which one's true and which one's distorted, well, look at the details. For example, just one small example. In the biblical account, the boat that's to be built is rectangular in shape. It's built something like a barge. It's 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. Those are good dimensions for a boat that's going to float in a stormy sea. But in the Gilgamesh epic, the boat's square. Hmm. In fact, it says that it's to be built 180 feet long and wide and high. Well, that's a cube. A rectangular-shaped boat, like the Bible gives, is longer and wider than it is high, so it's likely to remain upright. But a floating box that's the same width and height and length, which is what the Gilgamesh epic has, well, that's going to roll over in rough seas, killing or injuring everyone inside. The biblical account makes more sense and fits the facts of science better as we know them.
This listener wants to know, can there be two or more valid interpretations of a Bible passage? That is, dual fulfillment, a valid hermeneutic principle when exegesis is done. What do you think?
I personally believe that in general, there's just one valid interpretation for any given passage. Our job as interpreters is to determine what that meaning is that was intended by the original author. If a passage can have multiple meanings, well, then really there isn't any way to validate what the original meaning really is. You know, God gave language to communicate truth, and since he's the same yesterday, today, and forever, I think that what he intended to communicate through his word should be consistent. Now, there are a small number of times where God will actually give multiple meanings. In Hosea 1, God tells Hosea to name his child Jezreel, which means the Lord scatters or the Lord sows. But then God also says that's going to be a sign of judgment. He says, I'm going to punish the house of Jehu for the massacre in Jezreel. Well, now the child's name, Jezreel, is referring to the city. And then he says, I'm going to break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel. Well, now it refers to the valley. So in that case, God says Jezreel means the child's name. I'm going to scatter the people. It's because of what happened in the city of Jezreel. I'm going to break their bow in the valley of Jezreel. But someday great will be the time when God sows them back in the land, also the name Jezreel. So in the absence of God saying this word actually means several things, I think it's always best to look for the one meaning intended by God.
Let's go to the prophet Ezekiel. Does chapter 28 of Ezekiel refer to both a literal man, the king of Tyre, and Lucifer, the devil?
Well, and to answer this one, I need to go into just a little bit more detail. Ezekiel very clearly indicates the beginning of each new section in his message against Tyre and Sidon with the phrase, the word of the Lord came to me. In chapter 26, he has a prophecy of Tyre's fall. In chapter 27, he gives a poetic lament, a song that's going to be sung over Tyre's fall. In chapter 28, the first 10 verses, he has a prophecy against the human ruler of Tyre. And in chapter 28, verses 11 to 19, he gives a description of the ultimate king of Tyre's fall. And then he ends by giving a prophecy on Sidon's fall, which is Tyre's sister city. Now, by using those specific phrases to introduce each section, Ezekiel makes it clear that the human ruler, the one in verses 1 to 10 of 28, and the ultimate ruler, the one in verses 11 to 19, are distinct individuals. The human ruler is an actual person. In fact, Ezekiel says, though he might claim to be a god, God will ultimately show he's nothing more than a man and not a god. He also makes it clear that the ultimate power behind the throne, that's verses 11 to 19, was someone who was more than just a mere human. In fact, he says there, he was in Eden. He was appointed as a guardian cherub. He was on the mountain of God. He was blameless from the moment of creation, and he was expelled from God's presence. Now, I think the reason Ezekiel does this is to show that the human king who thought he was a god wasn't even really the person in charge at Tyre. Rather, the ultimate king was someone that we know as Satan. The only thing the two shared in common was a sense of pride that made them think they were equal to God and the reality that God was going to judge them both for their pride.
I love it. We've been to the Old Testament, the New Testament. We talked about proper Bible study techniques and more, all in this one little segment. And you can be a part of it with your question if you'll email it to thelandandthebook@moody.edu. Charlie Dyer's devotional is next. I hope you stick around right here on The Land and the Book.